Hey, thanks for introducing me and thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure to give this talk. So I'll just start sharing my screen and tell me if you can see it. You see the presentation?
Yes, all good.
Okay, thank you. So, okay. Happy New Year to everyone and good day. So, I'm Suvrat, and I'm doing my doctoral research in areas related to gravitational waves. In the last year, at Hamburg Observatory, I've been exploring an idea of detecting gravitational waves using circular particle accelerators. As Andrew mentioned earlier, it's quite an interdisciplinary experiment concept. And we actually published a physical review, the paper titled Detection of Gravitational Waves in Circular Particle Accelerators, where we explore this experiment concept. We calculate the effects of astrophysical gravitational waves on proton bunch test masses in particle accelerators and explore ways to detect these effects on the proton bunch motion in order to detect the gravitational wave signal. To get some numbers and to see how feasible this idea is to implement, we conducted a case study on the Large Hadron Collider, which is of course the most famous and best circular accelerator facility on Earth. In this we actually focus on exploring the experiment concept rather than aiming it to be a white paper focusing on ways to implement it, because this topic is so interdisciplinary that we would need a lot of technical knowledge to figure that out. After we published this paper, we were contacted by the beam operation group at the LHC beam operation group at CERN regarding their project titled Physics Beyond Colliders. Where they're actually looking out to explore ideas where they can use the CERN facility to do experiments beyond the main particle physics goals for which the facility was created. And currently they're looking for using CERN, LHC to do experiments related to general relativity, and our topic fits right in. So we're continuing to explore the implementation of this idea. To start out my talk, I thought I would briefly outline the experiment concept. And as I was told by Andrew that the audience here is a mix of GW physicists and particle physicists. So after I outline the experiment concept, I'll briefly go over the fundamental concepts of gravitational waves, etc., so that we're all on the same page. And in this talk, I would like to focus more on the concepts and the result and the implications rather than the detailed calculations. Because it's, of course, as I said, it's very interdisciplinary, and this needs to be built on a lot to exactly figure out how to implement it. So to start off, I have a rough cartoon here, which outlines this experiment concept. So the idea is that gravitational waves, as we know, are produced by astrophysical sources in outer space, such as the merger of two black holes, etc. They were first detected in 2016 by LIGO. In the figure, so A is could be any astrophysical gravitational wave source. And these gravitational waves travel at the speed of light, and they are transverse waves. So the effect of gravitational waves is perpendicular to the direction of their propagation. And so I have shown that by the effect of passing of gravitational waves on a ring of circular test masses. So the idea you should try to visualize in your head is that as a gravitational wave propagates, it stretches and squeezes space-time, right, in two mutually perpendicular directions. And so the idea we want to explore is that when these gravitational waves pass through a circular particle accelerator, like what I've drawn in C, where you have, let's say, proton bunches, which are circulating close to the speed of light. So how do gravitational waves affect the motion of these proton bunches, and can we measure it? So, and if we can, then therefore the idea is that the signature of the gravitational waves is present in the information of the motion, basically the geodesics of these proton bunches. And so we could conduct a timing experiment where we time tag these proton bunches, for example, by detecting the synchrotron radiation is just one of the ways in which you could do it, because these proton bunches are in a bending magnetic field, so they emit synchrotron radiation. So if inside the detector you have some sort of a single photon detector connected to a high precision optical clock, for example, then you can time tag these proton bunches. So the concept here is that, well, the fundamental principle of detecting any gravitational phenomenon is that you need to compare two geodesics, right? So you can use any, whatever experimental technique you use, detection technique you use, is built on the foundation that any gravitational phenomenon is detected by comparison of two geodesics. So in this case, this occurs by a comparison between two clocks, right? So one clock is made up of the circulation of these proton bunches in the particle accelerator. And so this clock is sending information to an external high precision clock through the synchrotron radiation photons, for example. And these two clocks are not identical, right? They have different ticking mechanisms. So the concept is that gravitational waves affect the proton bunch clock in a different way compared to the atomic clock. And this is a way to compare two geodesics. And through this, you can possibly detect gravitational waves. So before I go more into the experiment concept, I would like to briefly revise the concept of gravitational waves. So as I mentioned, so there are transverse waves which travel close to the speed of light. So the effect is perpendicular to the propagation direction. So in the GIFs above, you see a gravitational wave propagating into the computer screen. And the effect you see is on a ring of test mass particles. So as the gravitational waves pass through, these test mass particles start moving in the way that you see. And one more property of gravitational waves is that they are traceless. That means the effect, they have equal and opposite effects on two mutually perpendicular directions, right? So if there's a stretching in the x direction, then at that time there's a squeezing in the y direction. And just like electromagnetic waves, gravitational waves can have two polarizations. But the difference is that in electromagnetic waves, the polarizations are 90 degrees apart. In gravitational waves, they are 45 degrees apart. And also, far away from the source, gravitational waves behave like plane waves, right? Plane propagating waves. They have a propagation direction. An obvious effect is that if the observer is oriented differently with respect to the propagation direction, then the effect of gravitational waves would involve the angular parameters associated with the orientation. So for example, the inclination, the azimuth, and the polarization angle would determine the effect as seen by that observer. Okay, so that much is clear. Yes, so in laser interferometry is one of the techniques which utilizes, which exploits this effect to detect gravitational waves, right? So in this case, you can have a Michelson interferometer, and the test mass mirrors of the interferometer are basically, so the mirrors of the interferometer are basically the test masses, which move relative to each other when a gravitational wave passes through them. And that changes the path length of the laser beam, which of course causes a fluctuation of the interference pattern. And so the gravitational wave signal is present in the interference pattern. So this, our detection technique that we propose is completely different from laser interferometry, right? So a little bit more about the different types of detectors which can be used to detect gravitational waves, and also the sources which produce gravitational waves, is that in the diagram on the right, on the y-axis you have the characteristic strain of gravitational waves, which is basically like the strength of the gravitational waves, and on the x-axis you have the frequency, and these colored boxes are basically all the expected gravitational wave signals that have been predicted from the various kinds of astrophysical events that occur in outer space. So, and these black curves correspond to the detector sensitivity curves of various gravitational wave detectors. So on the right side, you can see on the topmost curve on the right side, it corresponds to LIGO. So the way you read these curves is that all the events above, lying above the curve, are detectable, and the ones lying below are not detectable, right? That's why it's called the sensitivity curve. So ones above, the detector is sensitive to the events above the curve. So LIGO, for example, is sensitive to compact, binary in spirals. So let's say neutron stars, two neutron stars in spiraling and merging into one another, or two stellar mass black holes. So those produce high frequency gravitational waves. Whereas you have other events such as massive binary black holes, or something called extreme mass ratio in spirals, which is like when you have one massive binary black hole and a very lighter, smaller compact object. So that means they have a extreme mass ratio. So even these kinds of events produce gravitational waves in a different frequency range. So these are called millihertz gravitational waves because they produce millihertz gravitational wave frequency. So these kinds of events are expected to be detected by a different kind of gravitational wave detector, which is also based on the principle of laser interferometry, called LISA, Laser Interferometer Space Antenna. But this one is set to be launched in 2034, and it will be a space-based detector. So LIGO is present on Earth, whereas LISA will be in outer space. In fact, it will be in an orbit around the Sun, lagging the Earth by around 20 degrees. So, okay, a bit more into the details of this. So in any detection technique for detecting gravitational waves like LIGO or LISA, you have noise sources which interfere with the signal that you're trying to detect, right? So for example, the two major sources of noise for laser interferometry are, first of all, gravity gradient noise. So what's that? So imagine that I'm standing near a LIGO facility and I start walking, or I start moving my hand. Then that means that the mass distribution around LIGO is changing just because I'm I'm moving, right? That changes the local Newtonian gravitational potential. So basically my movement or any human activity or any atmospheric activity, like wind blowing, etc., is causing a tidal gravitational effect directly on the test mass mirrors. And you can't screen against this, right? Because it couples directly with the mass. So then LIGO cannot tell apart whether the test mass moved because of a gravitational wave or whether it moved because of the human activity, etc. So that is gravity gradient noise, and that is very dominant at low frequencies. In fact, at the millihertz frequencies, it is so high that you cannot perform laser interferometry on Earth to detect millihertz gravitational waves. So that's why you have to go to space to minimize these kinds of gravity gradient noise. And at the higher end of the frequency range, you have thermal noise, which could be due to the photon shot noise, because the laser is, of course, made of photons, and those photons impinge on the test mass mirrors. And you have other kinds of thermal noise, high frequency. And the final thing is that in laser interferometry, the path length of the laser beam determines which frequency range of gravitational waves the detector is sensitive to. So on Earth, LIGO has a interferometer path length of around 4 kilometers. But at the same time, they are reflecting the laser beam around 400 times inside the arm length to have around 1600 kilometers effective path length. So that kind of path length is sensitive to high frequency gravitational waves, whereas LISA will have a path length of 1 million kilometers in outer space. So that would be sensitive to millihertz gravitational waves. So now, conceptually, we want to move from this. We want to compare laser interferometry technique to this detection technique, right? So what you need to realize is that if you imagine you have if you take the ring of test masses, which we saw earlier, right, and confine them to move in a circular trajectory. So in this case, there is no radial motion, right, so they can only move in a circle, and you give them some velocity. So unlike the LIGO or LISA test masses, which are stationary, in this case you have moving test masses, right? So if they're circulating with a constant velocity, let's say close to the speed of light, then you realize that this is the exact scenario that is present inside a circular particle accelerator. So you have proton bunches, which act as test masses, which are circulating close to the speed of light. And you want to answer the question that if a gravitational wave passes through the circular accelerator, what is the effect on the motion of proton bunches? And can we detect it? And does it contain the signature of the gravitational waves? Right. So we made these calculations, and we found that the passage of gravitational waves would change the travel time of these test masses. And if we can detect this change in travel time by conducting a timing experiment, then we can detect gravitational waves using a circular accelerator. And the advantage of circular accelerator is that the noise sources that affect laser interferometry work differently in this detection technique. And due to that, due to the details of that, you can use this detection technique even on Earth to detect gravitational waves, which in the case of laser interferometry, you could not do. So first of all, I would like to talk about the exact effect of gravitational waves on the proton bunches. So the way we made the calculations is that we had to do general relativistic calculations, right? We started by taking the GW metric, which is a linearized gravity metric in the transverse traceless gauge, quite well known. Then what you can do is you can, to account for a general orientation of the gravitational wave, you can do a coordinate transformation on the metric, right? Taking into account the inclination, azimuth, and the polarization angle of the gravitational wave propagation direction, as we saw in one of the earlier slides. And then you could move to a cylindrical coordinate system and impose a circular trajectory of the motion of test mass particles. For example, you could set dz is equal to zero, dr is equal to zero, so you can impose, therefore, a circular motion. And then you look at the time-like geodesic equations, right, and you integrate them to find the geodesics of the test mass particles. And what you find is that there is a deviation of the test mass particles from its nominal value. So this delta TGW, which you see on the right side, is basically the travel time difference in the presence of gravitational waves as compared to the travel time in the absence of gravitational waves. So what we find is that these, so in a particle accelerator, if you have proton bunches and you are doing a timing experiment, then you would expect that if a gravitational wave passes through, then the arrival times of your proton bunches will periodically start changing from the expected value, and the periodicity will go as the frequency of the gravitational wave, right? And of course, there will be a dependence on the direction in which the GW is incoming, which is given by this QFS, which is basically nothing but the antenna pattern of this detector. And finally, you can estimate the magnitude of this effect. In our paper, we calculate a very general formula to calculate the travel time change. But then to get some numbers out of it, to get an estimate of how much this travel time change would be, we use for simplicity an ansatz of a linearly polarized sinusoidal gravitational wave, which could correspond to, say, a continuous gravitational wave emission from, you know, the in spiral of massive binary black holes. So when you make that ansatz and put it in the general formula, which you can find in our paper, you get something like this. That the magnitude goes as proportional to the strength, which is the strain of the gravitational waves, and inversely proportional to the frequency. So you see, if you have strong gravitational waves which are low frequency, then you can maximize this effect of the travel time change. So if we go back to this diagram where we have the expected predictions of gravitational waves, then you see that it so happens that the lower frequency gravitational waves are expected to be stronger anyway, right? So we would have the insight that the lowest frequency gravitational waves would produce the strongest effect. But at the same time, there is a limit to the how low of a frequency you can go to, because let's say at a frequency of 10 to the minus 8, you would have to conduct your experiment for a really long time, say at least 10 to the 8 seconds, to measure, to see a measurable change. So that is unfeasible, right? So the millihertz regime happens to be the one where this effect of the change in travel time of circulating test masses is maximized and at the same time feasible to detect, right? So that's why this detection technique is most suitable for millihertz gravitational waves. Okay, so here I would like to show a comparison between the antenna pattern, which is like the pointing of your gravitational wave telescope, and the comparison between the LIGO pattern versus something like what I'm calling the LHC gravitational wave observatory. So if you're using a circular particle accelerator as a gravitational wave observatory, and a few insights we can get from this is that gravitational wave observatories point in all directions, unlike an astronomical telescope, which points in a single direction. And In the case of our detection technique, you can see that the travel time change is actually null for gravitational waves propagating along the z direction. So in this case, actually, the circular accelerator is in the xy plane, and the z-axis is perpendicular to it, with the origin being at the center of the circular accelerator, right? So the reason that it is null for gravitational waves propagating along the z is because we saw earlier that gravitational waves are traceless. They have equal and opposite effects in two perpendicular directions. So that somehow nullifies this effect of travel time change. Whereas if you have gravitational wave propagating edge on with respect to the circular accelerator, then that maximizes this effect. Okay, so now, as with any detection technique for detecting gravitational waves, you would expect noise sources which interfere with the signal that you're trying to measure. So we try to make a list of noise sources we would expect. And again, to get some numbers, we looked at the studies which have been conducted on LHC. We took those numbers and we plugged them in to make some estimates. So one of the basic things that the first thing that comes to mind is that if you do any kind of timing experiment, then the Heisenberg uncertainty principle applies, right? So that sets a lower limit on the uncertainty in time tagging. And at the LHC, we calculate this quantum noise to be of the order of 10 to the minus 20. So there are a few insights here that it's because the proton bunches are circulating close to the speed of light that they're ultra-relativistic, that we move out of the quantum regime, right? So they're no longer, you can treat them as classical relativistic particles. So if they were slow-moving protons, then as soon as you time tag them, they would be thrown away. So it's good that they, it favors the detection technique that they're moving close to the speed of light. And then you have, of course, again, gravity gradient noise, because the surrounding mass distributions, like sun, the moon, like near CERN, you have the Alps mountains, you have Mont Blanc, all those kind of things, they are gonna apply a tidal gravitational force directly on the protons, right? And well, there are a few insights here as well. This works completely differently compared to how it works in LIGO. Right, in LIGO you have stationary test masses. So if your external mass distribution is changing, that's going to apply a gravity gradient noise. But in this case, your test mass itself is moving, right? So even if you have a stationary object nearby, the proton bunch is circulating within the gravity gradient of that stationary mass, like a mountain nearby maybe. So that's going to act like a drag directly on the proton bunches, and it's going to slow them down. It's going to be very tiny, but it's going to be present nevertheless. And you have to account for this if you're trying to look at, if you're trying to see the effect of gravitational waves, right? And again, you can have seismic noise, and this also acts, in this detection technique, it acts completely differently compared to laser interferometry. So in this case, the good thing is that in a circular accelerator, the proton bunch test masses are not in mechanical contact with anything, right? They're inside a vacuum tube, but they're magnetically coupled to the dipole magnets which bend the trajectory into a circle. But these dipole magnets are connected to Earth, right? So if the Earth shakes due to seismic activity, then these magnets can move relative to each other. And if the magnets move, then the orbit of the protons can be distorted, right? And if the orbit is distorted, then that changes the time it takes for the proton bunch to revolve. So that changes the travel time, basically. So this acts as seismic noise, right? So the good thing is that seismic activity cannot, because it couples only to the magnetic field, it cannot change the speed of the proton bunches, but it can change, it can distort the orbit, right? So that's seismic noise. And we make a very, very simple rough estimation at the LHC that is going to be of the order of 10 to the minus 17 seconds. And all these estimations have been done for an assuming an observation period that, let's say, you run this experiment for 24 hours. And here I would like to just, I would like to mention that in this experiment, we are not conducting any particle collisions, right? So we're using a circular particle accelerator as a storage ring. So the particles keep circulating, and you time tag them with separate detectors. You're not using any particle detectors. There are no collisions. Okay. Right. So at the LHC, you have this radio frequency system, which applies an oscillating electric field. And its role is to ensure that the proton bunches revolve with a constant circulation frequency, at a constant speed, and it also divides the proton beam into bunches, right, and many those sorts of things. And well, the precision of the implementation of this RF system causes a timing jitter on the proton bunch circulation times, and that RF noise is of the order of 10 to the minus 12 seconds. This is experimentally measured directly by the LHC people. So that would also cause a noise if you're doing a timing experiment, right? So this kind of timing jitter would act as a noise. And of course, any kind of detector that you're using to time tag the proton bunches would have an intrinsic error bar, right, or a timing jitter. So that, well, that depends on what kind of detector you're using, but we take that to be of the order of picoseconds based on the current stages of technology. I'll talk about this in the next slide. Okay. And finally, well, you don't have to use synchrotron radiation to time tag the proton bunches. That's just one way. There are other ways. But in case you're using synchrotron radiation, then that synchrotron radiation photons will have and arrival time statistics, right? So between two proton bunches, the photons which arrive to a detector will have a variance of the arrival time due to the photon statistics. And we make a calculation for the LHC that this photon shot noise basically goes as 10 to the minus 17 seconds. But that will completely depend on the wavelength range of your detector. So what I want to say is that if you have a broadband photon counting detector, which can detect photons over a broad wavelength range, then this photon shot noise will be reduced. Whereas if you have a narrow band detector, then this photon shot noise will increase, because by not detecting, by leaving out certain frequencies of light, you're basically increasing the spacing between the photons that can be detected. So the variance of so the photon shot noise will increase. So it depends on when if you're implementing this technique, and if you're using synchrotron radiation to do proton bunch time tagging, then you have to calculate the bandwidth of your detector. Right, so now I would like to make a distinction between a classification of two different types of noise sources, right? So number two and number three, gravity gradient and seismic noise, falls into a category called deterministic noise. So this does not cause a timing jitter, right? There is no stochastic or statistical variance associated with it. It can be a function in time, but it is noise because we do not have enough data to model this function. Right. If we knew all the source mass distributions around us, if we knew how the Earth is vibrating, then we can totally account for this. Right. So deterministic noise has to be accounted for. I mean, all noise can be reduced with technological solutions, but during data analysis, deterministic noise has to be accounted for. Right. Whereas the other noise sources are causing a stochastic noise, which is associated with the statistical distribution. Right. So they are causing a timing jitter. So when you think of noise, what you visualize is usually stochastic noise, right? When you visualize noisy data, right, with a lot of variance. So this kind of noise can be overcome using noise filtering techniques. Like if, for example, the people working on GW data analysis, you were using matched filtering, right, to dig the signal out of this noise. Now, of course, we would like to talk a bit about what kind of detector would you be using to time tag these proton bunches. So, as I mentioned before, we're not in this experiment concept is not concerned with particle collisions. So we're not using the particle detectors in any circular particle accelerator facility. So because we want to time tag the proton bunches in as non-invasive a way as possible, right? So we want to monitor their geodesics without interrupting or destroying the proton bunches. So one of the ways to do that is, of course, by observing the synchrotron radiation, but of course there are many other ways. So at the LHC, actually, there is already a detector called the longitudinal density monitor, which is a single photon system, which detects the synchrotron radiations due to the proton bunches. And it so happens that at the LHC, the synchrotron radiation is in the visible UV range. So then you can use this kind of detector. And that has a timing jitter of 50 picoseconds. And another thing with single photon detectors is that you can have a dead time. So basically a recovery time, which has to pass before you can right. So if in case you're using a single photon detector to time tag your proton bunches, then we would like to comment on the current status of technology as to how precise you can make the detector. So we have these things called superconducting nanowire single photon detectors, which at the moment are very highly precise. So like they have sub 3 picosecond timing jitter and few gigahertz photon count rate. So the photon count rate is basically the inverse of the dead time, right? How frequently you can count photons. And they have a very high detection efficiency, right? So 90 chance that the photon which falls on your detector will be detected. And they have a very low dark count rate, so low false counts. And they can even operate over a broad wavelength range, as we saw, which is beneficial for our technique to reduce the photon shot noise. And this detector, which will plan to use an external clock to compare the proton bunch clock rate. If you use an atomic or optical clock, well, that clock has to have a least count, which is much smaller than the effect that you're trying to measure, right? So if your least count is bigger than the effect you're trying to measure, then you can't measure anything. But it so happens that modern optical clocks have a very small, a very good timing precision of 10 to the minus 19 seconds, which is great because the effect that we're trying to measure is of, at best, 10 to the minus 16. So then you can possibly, if you implement this, you can hope to detect the entire GW signal waveform, right? So we can assume that in somehow you can figure out how to make a detection system which can accurately time tag these proton bunches. So the final result is that if you perform this kind of experiment successfully, and let's say you can account for the deterministic sources of noise, and you use noise filtering techniques to overcome stochastic noise, and you figure out all the technical details, and what kind of events can you expect to observe with this kind of observatory, let's say you actually implement this at the Large Hadron Collider, then we predict that so basically what you see in the figure above is the sensitivity curve of predicted roughly for this kind of LHC GW detector. So this exactly corresponds to, it's just the millihertz part, which has been reproduced here. So you can see there's an overlap with the LISA sensitivity curve. So there are some events which can be potentially detected with both LHC and LISA together. And this is great because if you have events which are simultaneously detected by different GW observatories, then you can that helps to figure out where the GW source is located in the sky, right? So some information you need here is that need to know is that in with the GW observatory, the way you detect a source, where the GW source is located, is by the method of triangulation, right? So the same event detected at different observatories can is used to perform a triangulation to figure out the area in the sky where the GW source is likely located. So LISA, which is also, as we saw, Millihertz GW observatory, would be lagging the Earth orbit by 20 degrees. And that has expected to have a sky localization of around 100 square degrees, which is not good enough to identify exactly the galaxy where the GW event is located, right? So at best, you can have an area on the sky which contains millions of galaxies, and you don't know exactly which one of those contains the GW event. But then if you have more detectors, like, so for example, you even have the Chinese proposition for a LISA equivalent a space-based detector. And then in this case, if you can have a millihertz GW detector on Earth, then you have an additional baseline for performing your triangulation. So that will improve the angular resolution of your the sky localization, right? Yes, and one final effect that I would like to point out is that when you're trying to measure millihertz gravitational waves on Earth, right, you have to account for the fact that Earth is rotating. So the orientation of your gravitational wave will be changing relative to the orientation of your detector. So that will change the response of the detector with time. Right? So that's something that you have to take into account for. Well, I would like to conclude by looking at some of the exciting possibilities. If we can actually implement this detection technique, then so what we have shown is that it's possible to detect millihertz gravitational waves on Earth, right? And which can be, and this can be carried out using existing facilities like LHC and the other circular accelerators which exist. So right, you don't have to build something like LIGO or LISA from scratch over many decades. You can somehow figure out how to modify these existing facilities in case to perform the experiment. And then this kind of detector, as I mentioned, can complement the space-based detectors for pinpointing the gravitational source in the sky. And by looking at the current status of technology, it seems quite feasible that we can implement this in the near future. And you can also think of the exciting possibility that the space-based detectors, which are set to launch in the next decade, if we can implement this technique before that, then we could possibly detect these millihertz gravitational waves before the launch of LISA, right? I would like to conclude by saying that if there's one thing you take away from this talk, it is that you should focus less on the technical details of how exactly we need to implement this technique in circular particle accelerators, because that requires a lot more research, right? Because we're not the experts on circular accelerator facilities. So, and this is a very interdisciplinary experiment concept. But the fundamental, the main concept that you need to understand is that independent of particle accelerators, even if you have a ring, for example, a circular tube, which contains, let's say, ball bearings, right? And there's no friction between the tube and the ball bearings, right? And these ball bearings can then circulate with a constant velocity. Then even for this, model, the gravitational waves would have the same effect on the travel time chain. So the insight is that this model applies, this is exactly similar to what is happening inside a circular particle accelerator. So we look for this effect over there. So that's the main experiment concept that we explored in our paper. So where do we go with this? Of course, this is very basic at the moment. We just started exploring this concept. If this is actually feasible, then there's a lot more to be built on top of this. So we were we're in talks with the LHC beam operation group at CERN, as I mentioned earlier, to explore these ideas further. And of course, none of us is the expert on all this. Lot of knowledge which is required is quite interdisciplinary. So I guess it would really help if many people are working on this to take forward this idea, to actually try to implement it successfully. So if you have any ideas for follow-up, etc., then you're welcome to contact. Thank you. I guess I'm mostly on time. So thanks.
Thank you so much for that great talk. So I think we can open the floor for questions. I see we have a few. So why don't we start with Giacomo?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot, Subrat, for the very nice talk. I have a question. Yes. How important is the accelerator size? I mean, is the size of the LHC really relevant for your timing idea or not?
So in fact, that's related to the last thing that I said, is that when you consider the model of the ball bearings inside of it, removing the insight that this is happening inside a circular accelerator, we find that actually this travel time change is independent of the radius or the size of that ring. Mm-hmm. Yes. So, when you actually try to carry out this in a circular accelerator, at that time the size would be relevant, but it would not affect the signal that you're looking for, but rather it would be relevant for the noise sources. Mm-hmm. Right? So if for LHC you have a very, very big, you know, facility which is 27 kilometers, then that is more susceptible to be affected by seismic activity compared to if you have a smaller one, then I guess that would be less affected by seismic activity than a larger observatory facility. Also, then it would be, I'm not an expert on this, but then there must be some correlation between the size of the accelerator and how fast you can make the proton bunches go. And in our case, it is helpful that the closer to light speed you can make the proton bunch spin, the more you can reduce something like gravity gradient noise and say quantum noise, etc. So the more ultra relativistic the particles are, the better it is for this experiment. Okay. Size of the facility comes in, it is connected to the noise sources rather than the effect that we're looking for.
Okay, but are you saying that you considered the other facilities in the world and you came up with a conclusion that the LHC is anyway the most appealing?
No, we did not do that. Because in our paper, we only took LHC as a case study, right? It is left to explore, right? You can take the same calculations and apply them to all the other facilities in the world. I mean, in principle, you can do it with any of them, but then it's the noise sources that would change. So you can take the same things, plug in the numbers for the other facilities and check out. So we did not do that. We just took LHC as a case study because it's the most famous, technologically advanced, and all the studies. There are a lot of studies already done on the LHC related to the seismic activity, etc., and they're readily available. So it was a perfect candidate for a case study to get some numbers out. So yes, it remains to be done for the other facilities.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, then why don't we take Jean-René's question straight after?
Yes, thank you. Very, very interesting idea. I was wondering two things, actually, but I think the first one you probably replied to. I was wondering if nuclei might be better than protons. because after all, CERN can also accelerate nuclear. But I imagine they are less relativistic, so that's probably the answer. But I was more worried about the fact that these beams are stabilized. So there is a whole beam optics that tries, you know, that has a feedback mechanism. And so that tries basically to correct for the timing. So would your signal be in the control loop, or would your would it work just the way you said? That's what I was wondering. And how would that beam optics interfere with what you propose?
Yes, so actually this is the most relevant question, which is the immediate step that needs to be explored to take this idea ahead. So so in the LHC, you have this radio frequency system, right, which controls the speed of the proton. So it, if there is anything that tries to deviate the proton bunches, then it makes a correction, bring them back to the required speed. So you would imagine that if this system is, you know, ideally 100% precise, then it would cancel out any kind of effect that tries to change the proton bunch travel time. But the thing is that, as we saw here, that I mentioned here, that the precision of the implementation of this RF system is not perfect, right? So as you said, there are many feedback loops and et cetera. So the radio frequency implementation itself causes a timing noise of the order of picoseconds. And the signal that we are trying to measure is, as we saw, 10 to the minus 16 at best. So it's four orders of magnitude smaller than the noise created by the optics itself. So it remains to be seen that in this case, because the signal is smaller than the noise of the system, that it cannot, the RF system cannot adapt or cancel out this the signal that we're looking for. So it might be buried inside the noise, which you can then extract through noise filtering techniques. But in the case that the RF system can adapt, right, then you can actually look at the energy drawn by the RF, right? If it happens that the RF system canceled out any change in travel times, then that means the proton bunches drew extra energy from the RF in order to do that. So then the signal is in fact present in the energy drawn by the RF. In fact, at the LHC, they already have measured this for the effect of tides due to the sun and moon, right? Which changed the structure of the ring. So they have to account for that. So the RF system adapts to that and keeps the proton circulating at the constant frequency. But to do that, of course, energy is extracted from the RF system. So if you look at the energy, then you can see the effect of the tides in there. So the same would be with this. But then, of course, because it is very small, you would have to have high precision technology.
I was also thinking, if I may pursue a little bit, about the optics of the system, because your protons are not on a circular trajectory. They get focused by quadrupoles, sextupoles, and so on. So that creates some noise, I imagine, from your point of view. And I don't see it in this list. I mean, maybe it's very small, I don't know.
I think it must be present in the number four, the radio frequency noise, because this one, actually, the reference that we use to get this number, they have experimentally measured the timing jitter. So all of that combined must be present in that somewhere.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, then, Marco?
Hi, sorry, I had to unmute. Thanks a lot for this extremely interesting proposal. So I'd like to come back to this question about protons versus heavy ions, whether there are any advantages or disadvantages. And you mentioned that the timing is crucial. Now, of course, in relativistic motion, I mean, these particles don't really get that much faster when you make them more relativistic, right? In terms of in terms of physical speed, they become more, the gamma becomes bigger, but the So what is the importance? So does it actually make, so I mean, what is the important factor here when it comes to signal to noise like and backgrounds and these kind of things? Is it the speed of the particles, or is it the boost, so to say, the rapidity?
Okay, so I would say that because in general relativity, actually, due to the equivalence principle, the mass of the object doesn't matter, right? So that's why in our calculations, when you calculate these time-like geodesics, etc., the mass doesn't come in anywhere, right? So this, the effect that you're looking for is independent of the mass. But again, I guess the mass would be relevant for other effects, like say, for example, the quantum noise, right? So if you're using a lighter particle, and if in some way you want to time tag this particle, then a lighter particle has a greater chance to be thrown off by an observation made on it. So I guess it would come there. But then again, if you're in the ultra-relativistic regime, even that would not matter that much, I guess. But yes, but the effect that we're calculating
Yes, please. Yeah, sorry to interrupt you. I mean, of course, these are in GR, of course, it shouldn't really make a difference. But when it comes to practically operating the LHC, when it comes to what are the backgrounds, what are the technical problems, I think it is quite different if you run it with heavy ion beams or if you run it with proton beams. So therefore, it could be that even though fundamentally there's no big difference as far as GR is concerned, from a technical measurement viewpoint, it could make a huge difference. And that's why I'm saying, like you said, that timing information is important. And that's why, then of course, the heavy ions are have a slightly smaller rapidity. But in terms of speed, they're actually not that much slower. So I'm saying it could be that it might be worthwhile to look into that option.
Definitely,
But sorry, I interrupted you. I didn't. Please finish what you wanted to say. Sorry.
Mostly, I guess you answered your own question here. So it would be interesting to look exactly what the effect of... I don't see any prohibition of using heavier ions compared to proton bunches. It should be possible with that. Those as well.
So what you rely on is actually the speed of the particles, not the rapidity. That's the important... in the lab frame. So that is the important question. Sorry, just to rephrase my question in a more understandable way.
Yes, but then again, because these calculations are general relativistic, so the boost, so the gamma factor is involved in that. So you can, I don't know if it would be sensible to think about separating the thinking in terms of speed versus the boost, because in the end, the thing that goes into the equation is the boost itself, right? So,
fair enough. Yeah. Well, but what you measure in the lab frame, because the lab frame breaks GR invariant, so what you measure in the lab frame is time, so it's a specific coordinate, Okay, anyway, I don't want to, it's just a thought experiment, Thanks.
Okay, yes, thank you.
Okay, then I think Joris had a question.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah, I can only echo what others are saying. It's a very nice concept. I had, and I also looked a little bit at the paper, at your gravity gradient noise that you really focus on very big things like Alp mountains and the Mont Blanc nearby. And in the paper, you're talking about a big skyscraper and such. But I would expect, and that then refers to very local sources, you say, but I would have expected also, the soil around the LHC pipes and the seismic waves at the relevant lengths that your frequency to also be in that estimate. So I was a bit surprised by that. Could you comment on that?
So you're talking about the gravity gradient noise caused by the fact that seismic activity would also move the mass of the Earth around the LHC, right?
Yeah, change the mass distribution, the soil.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the thing is, this would have to be looked into in greater detail. Because well, if you start thinking about it impromptu, then the fact that, well, the circulation of the proton bunches is perpendicular to the plane in which the motion of, well, actually, I don't think I can make a definitive comment on that. This would really have to be looked into. But the key difference is that, I would like to comment, is that in this detection technique compared to laser interferometry, laser interferometry has stationary test masses. So they're affected more by objects which move around it, right? That's the gravity gradient noise that affects
In this case, which frequency, right? So if you're very...
It's totally dependent on the frequency.
Yeah.
But in this case, you have your test masses are moving, right? So in some way that greatly attenuates the gravity gradient noise due to moving objects, and focuses more on the gravity gradient noise due to stationary objects.
But they have to be, yeah, that's also what I didn't understand. They have to be somehow moving as well, even though they're stationary, right?
No,
because it's else because it's just a static, you know, if those bunches are moving around a static Newtonian potential, then there won't be any effect on their timing.
In fact, there will, because let's say you have, for example, you have Mont Blanc, the mountain, which is 100 kilometers away from LHC. And let's say that you it faces edge-on with the plane of the LHC, just for a thought experiment, right? And the proton bunches are circulating. And when they circulate, they're basically traversing back and forth through the gravity gradient of this mountain, right? So when they are moving away from the mountain is pulling it back, directly applying a gravitational force on the test mass and pulling it back. And when they are moving towards the mountain, it is accelerating them, right?
So yeah. So how would that stationary thing that you're describing have any effect on delta t of a
yes, so it does, because if you make the calculation, that is in fact the calculations that you see in the paper, that this moving test mass traversing within the gravity gradient of a stationary object experiences a drag, which causes a slow buildup of time delay.
Yeah, so that's what you're saying here as well.
Yes, that is the effect in the paper.
And then if I have one more time, you were talking about how seismic noise is not a big problem for you because it couples via this magnetic stuff. But doesn't it also couple via the RF accelerator components?
Well, if it does, then that is already present in the radio frequency noise, which has been experimentally measured, right? So that we already know that.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Thanks. Yeah. Cheers, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, are there any other questions?
Andrew, I wanted to make a comment on the previous discussion.
Sure, go ahead.
So, I think the point that Joris wanted to make is that, for instance, the LHC does not sit at the same depth all along its path. Mm-hmm. So, apart indeed from considering distant masses like the Alps and so on, perhaps the first thing that one should check is the amount of material above the accelerator on each every point is present.
If I may build on that, in fact, even better thing would be to somehow map the gravity gradient around the circular accelerator ring.
Yeah.
So if you experimentally map it, then you don't need to individually think about the various mass distribution.
Yeah.
You
so I was coming to this. I mean, all these things, I think it's easily computed, right? And plugged in your calculation. So I understand that you call it deterministic noise, but in the end, you can easily, well, relatively easily calculate it.
Yes.
On the other hand, I was a bit surprised that you put in the same category the seismic noise due to seismic waves on the surface of the Earth, mostly, I guess, but also underground. I mean, that is far from being deterministic. You need to monitor it and hope to subtract it in a way or another. So why does that cause a build-up of the time delay and not fluctuations in one sense?
And
that is not clear at all to me.
Yes, that is actually a surprising result because, why is it included in deterministic? Is the only reason it is put into deterministic is that it is not stochastic. It doesn't cause a fluctuation. And this is a bit counterintuitive, but if you think about it, if you follow a proton bunch in a distorted orbit, and if you assume that the distorted orbit is fluctuating from the ideal circular orbit, then the thing is that as long as the proton is circulating in a distorted orbit, it would build up a time delay. And when the orbit returns back to normal, right, this time delay would not be reduced back, right? So whatever delay is built, it remains, right? That's why you cannot have a fluctuation, right? Once you have a time delay, it cannot be undone by distorting the orbit in any way. So I guess intuitively what we imagine is that because the orbit is fluctuating, then the time should also be fluctuating. But the thing is that the minimum delay in the fluctuation of time is zero, right? So any distorted orbit can only build up a time delay. It cannot undo any built up time delay. So it only keeps increasing with time. Does that make sense?
Thanks. I should read your paper for sure. Thanks.
Yeah.
So do we get cut off wavelength waveforms then?
Or I'm not sure. I mean, we have to explore all more.
Are there other questions? I mean, maybe I have one. Did you consider other observation times besides 24 hours, and how would that affect the sensitivity if you have a buildup of this noise?
Yes. So these numbers are only over observation time of 10^4 seconds. But the calculations we made in our paper, although they're simple estimates to get orders of magnitude, they do have the time dependence. So the longer you observe, the more these, especially number 2 and 3, will build up, right? So I guess there would be a period where the noise becomes too much, right? So that would limit the observing time of your experiment, unless you can somehow, through technology, reduce those noise sources. So somehow or the other, you have to either account for it or reduce it or limit your observing time so that you have the required noise threshold, which is enough for you to detect the signal.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's like the opposite of gravitational, like laser interferometry, because the more you observe, and plus the signals that you're trying to observe are basically are very close to monochromatic or just continuous signals that are spinning up or spinning down very slowly. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting.
Oh, but even that would actually help because what you said is about laser interferometry is that the longer you observe, the more precise, the more noise you can, the smaller the signal you can detect, right? And that's because you're using matched filtering, right? It's a noise filtering technique. And the thing about any noise filtering technique is that the effective noise is reduced by the square root of the number of data points you have, right? So that would so number of data points would be basically your sampling rate times the observing time. So the longer you observe, the more data points you have, then that can reduce, that can improve the noise filtering technique. So that does apply in our case. But at the same time, so there are two things that are battling each other, is that the more longer you observe, you have more data points, but at the same time, the longer you observe, your noise increases. So it's somewhere in between, there must be an optimization.
Can I ask you yet another question? Sorry, yes, that comes to my mind one after the other. So on this slide, you say the observation period would be 24 hours a day, and you give orders of magnitude of these differences in times. So did I understand well? Did I understand well? You need a reference time, so a reference clock, isn't it? For
yes,
and this would be an atomic clock.
Exactly. So that the experiment, the fundamental of this concept is that it's a comparison between two clocks, right?
Yeah, but
one
but
clock is
yes. So I'm pretty sure that the current accuracy of atomic clocks is at the level of 1 nanosecond per day. So
no, in fact, okay.
Am I wrong? So how do you hope to get to the level of
Actually, no. The best latest optical clocks have actually very fine timing precision of 10 to the minus 19 seconds. Right? Yeah, that's the least count.
But what does it mean, least count?
Least count. So, like in any measurement, that's the least value that you can measure. Right. So.
Are these optical clocks the same as atomic clocks, or is this yet?
So they're called optical clocks, but I guess they're similar to atomic clocks. I mean, atomic clocks, optical clocks, they're, I guess, different types of the same thing.
Okay, but I'm pretty sure that atomic clocks have an accuracy of 1 nanosecond per day, so that's why.
It doesn't matter. You can use any clock you like, which is... which has a good enough least count. So, the fact that modern clocks have a least count of 10 to the minus 19 just says that even the current status of technology is good enough to implement this idea.
Okay, I have to check. Okay, thanks.
Yes, okay.
Are there any other questions? Okay, then thank you so much for this talk. It was really great.
Thank you.
And
thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah, of course. I hope people will stay in contact with you and I hope the work continues to go well.
Thanks a lot. Yes, I hope so as well.
Yeah. So bye for now.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye. Thanks a lot for the nice talk.